dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have long been impressed by the intelligence and the mastery of a particularly challenging front in that war, the Middle East, of our first guest. He is Matthew Brodsky. These days he is a senior analyst in Wikistrat's analytic community. He formerly directed policy for the Jewish Policy Center. He is a man who has just had a chance to visit with some senior folks in the White House about national security policy in the Middle East, and I wanted to talk with him about that, and also some of the important writing he's been doing of late at places like National Review and National Interest. Welcome, Matt. It's good to have you back, sir. It's been too long.
Good to be with you.
I wanted to start with the piece that you wrote the other day for National Review about Iran's Syria challenge to America, and ask you to sort of tease out what you see happening on the ground there at the moment. Are we playing sort of the proverbial checkers as others in the region are playing chess? And if you can, shed any light on what sort of the official thinking as imparted to you in this off-the-record conversation with senior officials yesterday tells you that perhaps allays some of your concerns and I hope ours.
Well, what we're seeing from the position of Assad is they have concentrated to begin with. You hear of how the United States has always blamed Russia and Assad for not really targeting ISIS. And of course, this has been true. They've been concentrating on the Idlib province in the northwest, the last pocket of resistance, which is which has been held by rebels, including other al-Qaeda affiliated groups. And that's around the main population centers and cities. And what the Assad regime and his backers have wanted to do is to concentrate on bringing that area under control before turning east. Now, with the United States having success in Raqqa in dealing with ISIS, then there has become the rush to fill in the void from all of the other patron states and countries who are involved on all sides of the conflict. So they want to fill in that vacuum area. And what we have is Iran having their main goal being involved in Syria, aside from propping up Assad, has been to create their Shia land corridor, a land bridge from Tehran to the Mediterranean Sea into Lebanon. And to do that, they've needed to capture essentially one of three main crossing points over land, one through Raqqa, one through Deir el-Zor, or one through Al-Tanf in the southeast, which is along the main Baghdad-Damascus highway. And that is where they've suddenly had to they've had to shift their focus and attention eastward. And at the same time, this is where the United States is. And it's increasingly putting the United States into situations where we're facing off against Iran and Iranian proxies and Assad's groups.
And as you see this playing out, and again, I'm interested in what the White House is suggesting is actually their policy. But Matt, it would seem as though we're not taking the long view here or the strategic considerations. Containing Iran, I think, is the way you put it in your piece at National Review. And it seems to me that that's exactly what we should be doing, if not actually rolling them up. Talk about that, if you would.
Initially, when you hear, especially after the U.S. downed the Syrian aircraft, what we heard from Pentagon spokespeople, from CENTCOM spokespeople, anyone involved with the military, and those are the ones who the administration has had out commenting, they've all said the target for the military target in Syria remains ISIS. And I pressed them on that in a quote from one of the spokespersons last week that basically said, you know, if Assad has the capability to use to help out in Dar al-Zor, then feel free to come along and, you know, we'll work. The impression that I received is more that they are certainly aware and know of the Iranian threat and situation, and then they see that as a far bigger issue with which they're dealing. When it comes to this, I didn't get anything 100% specific that I can quote, but what I can say is the way that they keep stressing the military target is ISIS in Syria, is that they're stressing quite deliberately the military target, because there are so many other ways that the United States can target Iran and in Syria. And part of that, we just saw yesterday, I was talking about Al-Tanf, which is a base in the southeast. We just moved a militia. It's our base. We just moved a militia, a large portion of it, to the northeast, which is closer to where Dar al-Zor is, and closer to Raqqa, but still even closer to Dar al-Zor. They're in a Kurdish area now, and they're going to be there for one purpose, is to make sure that ISIS doesn't escape and have a place to regroup. But also, it puts them right in the middle of a situation where Iran could get involved. And if they attack, then the comment that the White House uses, or that the Pentagon uses, the military target, is still accurate, because it's not our military. We're just backing up a proxy against another proxy.
This is a complicated business, and I think as it develops in the days ahead, we're going to need to have you come back and call the plays as best you can, because this is, I'm afraid, at the very best, highly dynamic and highly fraught. And at worst, I fear we really don't have a clue as to how we position ourselves, to say nothing of look out for the interests of our friends in Israel in the midst of this shifting of ground, as you say, into the south and east of Syria. Matt, before we have to run, let me just ask you quickly about another topic you've been focusing on. Speaking of bases, the Americans operate. We are, of course, using a very important facility in Qatar, the Al Udeid Air Base, and it's creating, it appears, some considerable dissonance, shall we say, within the administration about the crisis that has recently erupted there between principally the Saudis and their friends in the Sunni camp and the Qataris. Give us a quick sense of what's at stake there and how you see it playing out.
Well, the GCC states are and the Gulf region are, has been described to me, the cornerstone in that part of the region of our security. And they would like to see the situation with Qatar resolved clearly and quickly. But the main issue here is that there are some portions of the administration, specifically at the State Department, who are into seeing it resolved quickly rather than correctly. And I'm more interested in seeing it done correctly and hopefully as well quickly.
And talk about what correct would look like, as you said.
What we need is Qatar to stop supporting all forms of Islamists, even Shia Islamists, even Iranian proxies. So, and the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, and Hamas and Al-Qaeda affiliates that they have in northwestern Syria. There's a whole range, and they support more than most of the Gulf countries. Now, the fact is, even if we got them to cut back their support on, say, 2 out of 10, that's more successful than 0 out of 10. And I think our goal should, of course, be more than that. But the point is, we should use this opportunity now to apply pressure with the same. And everyone has the same goal. Let's bring them in to this coalition and to be on the same team. But let's do it from a position where they are acting more in accordance with what we'd like to see, rather than just, you know, being the upstairs old neighbor banging on the floorboards, you know, just keep it down. No, let's get them to move toward our position, and then let's get on the same page as quick as possible.
Well, this is critically important, and I've been very heartened by the president's comments, calling them out for their funding of terrorism, between Al Jazeera, as you say, their support for the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, their use of sovereign wealth funds, it would appear, in financial attacks against the United States, to say nothing of their aligning with Iran. This is a serious problem, not just for the region and our interests there, but I think for the United States as well. Matt, thanks for helping keep the pressure on, because when Rex Tillerson and the State Department seem to be undermining the president's position on this, I think it's extraordinarily unhelpful. It's very, very important work, and we're very pleased to be able to further showcase it here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us Patrick Dunleavy, the former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections, a man who has personal firsthand knowledge as a result of his career in the correction system, as well as his serious study of it now in the private sector, notably working for Steve Emerson at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, about what I call jihad in jail. He has described it brilliantly in his book, The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. I'm thrilled that he is a professor at the terrorism for a class on terrorism at the United States Military Special Operations School, an outfit that can greatly benefit from his insights in all of these matters, and as do we when he is able to visit with us. Patrick, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have been on this case for a long time, and you've brought to the fore recently in a piece that you wrote for the Investigative Project on Terrorism, the sort of case study of a fellow by the name of Edwin Lorenzo Lemons. Talk a little bit about him, Patrick, and why he's sort of a poster child of a problem that isn't getting the attention it requires.
Well, the thing that's intriguing about Edwin is that he fits the pattern that we've seen over the years of an individual who's ripe for radicalization. His criminal history started when he was a teenager. He wound up in prison in New York for committing crimes of robbery. When he was there, he came in and declared his religion as Christian. Shortly thereafter, after meeting two individuals from the Middle East in the prison mosque, he converted to Islam, went on to study Arabic, went on to be paroled and go to the Islamic Center in Gainesville, Florida. And then from there, this kid, this poor African-American kid who never ventured outside of a small rural town in New York, suddenly became an international traveler. He got on flights going to Jordan, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, and other countries in the Middle East.
We're talking about one Edwin Lorenzo Lemons, also known as Asad al-Salam. And you were telling us about his travels overseas. What did he do in some of these Middle Eastern countries, Patrick?
Well, he attended madrasas that were tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. He also, and this is according to our source who knew both him and individuals in the Middle East, he received underground tactical training. We listened to him on tape conversations talking about his extremism. He even admitted to having extreme Islamic views on taped conversations. He was observed by the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Florida at a firing range, firing AK-47s and SKS assault weapons and practicing a tactical technique known as cover and concealment. He was coming back from one trip from Egypt. And when Lemons got off of an airplane at the Orlando airport, he was arrested by the Joint Terrorism Task Force and sentenced to a period of 27 months in a federal prison. After that, he, in the supervised release, somehow he wound up in Virginia as a member of the Muslim Chaplain Services of Virginia, and he became a licensed clergyman, licensed to perform weddings and also to minister to inmates. he was receiving a statewide institution pass to go to all the Virginia Department of Corrections institutes and teach inmates Arabic. This radicalized former inmate is now a chaplain for the whole Virginia Department of Corrections. It's incredible.
This is unfortunately not an isolated incident. As I understand it, Patrick Dunleavy, going back to the Clinton administration, a prominent Muslim Brotherhood operative, actually associated with al-Qaeda as well, by the name of Abdurrahman al-Amoudi, was given the initial responsibility to help establish facilities for the recruitment, the training, and credentialing of chaplains for the U.S. prison and, by the way, the U.S. military. It seems as though, as you talk about in your piece at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, this is a classic example of having foxes in one of the most dangerous hen houses you can imagine.
Yeah, and this whole issue, as you talk about, the unvetted radical clergy entering into correctional institutions or into military institutions has been known. The Department of Justice Inspector General's office put out a report that's recommended vetting them, extreme vetting, using not only security, but actually questioning their ideology before they were hired. And the National Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is overseen by the FBI, was charged with that particular issue when it came to corrections. So how Virginia would have allowed this individual in without at least, if they would have done a simple Google search, let alone a criminal history or any other type of background vetting, they would have seen the history that he has with radical Islamic ideology. It's just mind-boggling.
Even if we can't figure this out for ourselves, looking at what has been happening in Europe, which is unfortunately for them, farther along in much of this than we are, it's unmistakable that the kind of warnings you've issued about jihadism in our jails is translating into really insurgencies in some of these Western European countries in particular, where we've witnessed a growing tendency towards real violence being unleashed on the streets. You've made recommendations as to what should be done by most especially the Virginia Department of Corrections, but more generally, to try to prevent this sort of thing from persisting in this country. Go over those with us quickly, if you would.
Well, one of the things we said is that we go back to the recommendations of the Inspector General, which was the vetting of religious volunteers as well as hired clergy to do security backgrounds that not only looked at prior criminal history, but looked at their social media activity. We know that a lot of individuals have espoused radical views on social media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or something like that. So that has to be done. Surely talking to someone about their ideology is not a violation of their religious rights. If you're going to come in and teach inmates your particular ideology, well, then we need to know what it is. And the other thing is to know what organizations they belong to. For instance, in this Muslim Chaplain Services of Virginia, we found that they were tied to the Islamic Relief, which was a charity that had ties not only to the Muslim Brotherhood, but it was found later on to have funded Hamas. And in fact, the United Arab Emirates declared them to be a terrorist group. So those type of associations are the type of things that have to be done in the vetting too. What groups?
And you know, one other particularly important point that you made, Patrick Dunleavy, was you need to go audit as well the people who have been trained by these individuals. You know, what are they up to, either in the prison system or most especially if they've gotten out?
Sure. For 2 years, Edwin Lemons has been teaching inmates in Virginia. Many of those inmates have probably been released. Who are those inmates? Where did they go from their prison sentence to what places in the United States, what particular religious organizations or groups that they join? Yeah, that has to be done.
Yeah, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Patrick Dunleavy, this is such important work. I cannot thank you enough for what you've done in the correction system yourself and what you're doing now to try to make sure that it's protecting us as well as ensuring that the problems do not become even greater inside the system. Keep it up, my friend, at the investigative project on terrorism, and with the Special Operations Command, it's incredibly important. We're grateful to you for sharing your time with us. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Gertz. We'll get our weekly tour with him inside the ring right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Bill Gertz, one of the great national security reporters of our time. He has written a prize-winning column for the Washington Times called Inside the Ring for decades. He is also a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently InfoWar, The national security challenges in the information war age. Bill Gertz, it's a great privilege to have you with us when we have so much going on, and I'm anxious to get your take on it quickly. You've been warning for some time about Chinese, and Russian telecoms getting access to Pentagon infrastructure. The House Armed Services Committee seems to be worried about that, too. What's happening on that front now, Bill?
Yeah, hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. Basically, the Pentagon was aware of the fact that one of the big Chinese telecoms, ZTE, was subcontracting to a U.S. defense contractor and selling its equipment, which opens up the potential for cyber espionage and sabotage. And the House Armed Services Committee, which recently marked up the Fiscal 18 defense authorization bill, included language in there that would bar Pentagon from doing any kind of business with Chinese telecommunications firm for obvious reasons. It seems like a no-brainer, but yet the Pentagon in testimony last year said, well, we don't blacklist any companies. Hey, why not?
It just seems as though it's malfeasance not to preclude them from getting access to us inside the wire, as they say, Bill. That would seem to be of a concern to the incoming Deputy Secretary of Defense, Pat Shanahan. You had some testimony from him about concerns about cyber warfare and what needs to be done to deter it. Talk about that, Bill.
Yes. One of the big priorities for the Pentagon, and this was revealed in written policy questions to the Senate Armed Services Committee for Shanahan, who was up for the number 2 spot. And he identified cyber warfare as one of the pressing concerns, one of the top priorities for the Pentagon. And obviously, one of the problems has been there has been no cyber deterrence. It's been an open highway for foreign adversaries, primarily the Chinese and Russians, but also the Iranians and North Koreans, and probably in the future, the Islamic State terrorists, to do cyber attacks and to do damaging cyber information operations. And so they're setting up how to do deterrence in that area. And again, it's basically going to take some show of cyber force against some of these adversaries, something that the Obama administration for 8 years refused to do.
Bill, the People's Republic of China is also, according to your reporting, engaging at the moment on another front. They seem to be concerned about the possibility that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, might start casting his gaze their way in terms of Chinese influence operations aimed at the Trump family as well as administration. What do we know about what's going on there?
Yeah, the Chinese are, in my view, light years ahead of the Russians in information warfare and information operations. And they see that the anti-Russia hysteria that's sweeping Washington right now could very easily focus on China and create a backlash against China. So what they're concerned about were some recent reports that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump, had a meeting with one of the top Chinese billionaires of an insurance company called Anbang, which has purchased the Waldorf Astoria and was in the process of buying a building owned by the Kushner family in New York City. And clearly this was it was an overvalued sale that had all the trappings of a payoff to try and spy influence within the White House, Kushner being one of the top aides to President Trump. So the Chinese are trying to, and the head of Anbang disappeared recently, just fell out of sight. The company said he left the company for personal reasons, but all the intelligence agencies believe that this was a directive by the Chinese government, again, to try and lower China's profile and avoid any kind of a backlash. But it's something that should be focused on very heavily. I think the Chinese information warfare capabilities are far greater than those of Russia. And we're seeing that play out in the South China Sea. There's just reports this week of new military facilities on some three disputed reefs there.
Bill, this is a subject, of course, of your terrific book, Info War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Let me ask you, Bill, there was a report that the Chinese are trying to euchre the United States into ending their cooperation with the South Koreans, specifically military exercises, as a price for further Chinese help with the North Koreans. If ever there were evidence that this is all part of a, well, influence operation, I guess I would call it, a sort of diplomatic jujitsu by the Chinese to parlay their continued involvement with the North Koreans into new concessions by us of interest to them. This should be it, don't you think?
Yes, the Chinese during a recent summit meeting at the in Washington with senior officials, they proposed trying to play the role of so-called neutral broker in the North Korean crisis, and basically said that North Korea would give up its nuclear program in exchange for the United States to abandon its annual exercises. We do large-scale exercises with the South Koreans. It was met with a very dark response from the U.S. basically said that we have done this in the past and we're not going to do this again. But it shows you the position of the Chinese trying to appear as if they're neutral brokers when in fact they are working on behalf of the North Koreans.
It was heartening to see the president say in a tweet that his patience with the Chinese was at an end in terms of this this so-called cooperation on the North Korean front. Bill, let me turn finally to one of the other topics, coming back to your interest in and expertise about information operations, influence operations. You've written that the Islamic State now seems to be metastasizing with networks in Europe. There's certainly evidence of that in Asia as well. As they get rolled up in their home caliphate, it seems as though their tentacles are extending. You've written about a friend of ours, John Lanchowski. Dr. Lanchowski is the founder and chancellor of the Institute of World Politics, a terrific organization that has been teaching generations now of future policymakers about statecraft and intelligence and information operations and the like. When you look at this, you talked about his recent testimony before the Senate Homeland Security Committee. And the argument he's making that we're not doing nearly enough to fight the ideological warfare that's needed to defeat these Sharia supremacists like the Islamic State. Visit with us a little bit about that, if you would, Bill.
Yeah, this is very important testimony that got very little attention in the mainstream press. But John Lanchowski really made the point that for many years now, since 2001 in particular, we have been using the military, which is not well suited for a non-military problem. That is the problem of Islamic terrorism. And again, he is one of the leading advocates for applying Cold War counter-ideological warfare precepts, things that we used to defeat the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and applying those to the Islamic extremist problem. It's very important testimony. I hope that Congress steps up to the plate, and again, we shift the American policy to one that will focus on the ideology, because that's really the only way we can win is when we defeat that ideology.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Bill, and particularly the emphasis that John placed on both making the case of our superior moral precepts and truth-telling and ending the self-censorship that has afflicted really all of our efforts to understand, let alone counter, this ideological foe. Bill, thank you, as always, for the reporting that you do on all of these topics. We've just scratched the surface of them, but it's very, very important work, and we're very pleased to be able to further showcase it here at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll talk with Patrick Dunleavy about jail, jihad in jail, and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by James Simpson. These days, he is a freelance investigative journalist. He has formerly served in the government as an economist and budget examiner for the White House Office of Management and Budget. He has been widely contributing to the national public policy debate, particularly about matters involving immigration, but also a host of other things in outlets like Breitbart, The Daily Caller, Front Page Magazine, and more. He is a regular contributor at examiner.com. He is also an old friend and colleague, and I'm delighted to welcome him back. Jim, thanks so much for having him.
Hey, Frank. Great to be with you.
I wanted to talk with you, Jim, a little bit about the subject of your terrific book published by, I'm proud to say, the Center for Security Policy Press, Red Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America. And in particular, Jim, to ask you to talk about, in a way, the poster child of that red-green axis these days, an outfit called the Southern Poverty Law Center, or SPLC. Tell us about it.
This is very typical for leftists. It's a marriage of people who want to find a way to get really rich with people who want to destroy our country. So Morris Dees, the founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and his former partner made no bones about the fact that they just wanted to be very rich, and they really didn't care how they did it. And this is a direct quote or paraphrase from his partner, Millard Fuller, and a former partner. And anyway, so they started that, and they founded it with the person who ran for the Georgia legislature three times and was turned down because of his communist connections. He was on the board for his entire life, and he was good friends with Herbert Marcuse. And Herbert Marcuse, a communist who came over in the 1930s, he was a Frankfurt School Marxist, the Frankfurt School of Social Research, which was a Marxist school whose entire purpose was to study the West to determine how best to destroy it. And he came over here fleeing Nazi Germany in the 30s and set up shop at the new Frankfurt School at Columbia University, where he and his fellows began teaching at Columbia Teachers College and then spread throughout Ivy League system in the United States. And Marcuse, his best known work is something called Repressive Toleration, which he described as America being incurably racist and imperialist, and the only way to overcome that would be to practice partisan tolerance, or liberating tolerance, he called it, which is tolerance of ideas from the left and complete intolerance of ideas from anybody else. So the idea was to shut down debate, shut down people, shut up anybody that wasn't a leftist. And that's what the SPLC actually took on as its mission.
Hey, Jim, this is an important sort of background to what is really now a political warfare machine in the service of the most extreme partisans of the left and the Islamists, hence this, as you've called it, red-green axis. One of the other telltales that recently came to our attention was the fact that we had John Rossomondo on yesterday, as a matter of fact, talking about this, that one of the outlets that routinely propagandizes and pushes out the screeds of the Southern Poverty Law Center is this People's World. Talk about them and the placement service that apparently makes that possible.
Well, the People's World is the communist newspaper. It's the communist outlet. And the organization, and I can't remember off the top of my head the name of it, but the organization is a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And the Institute for Policy Studies, well, people call it the most influential hard left think tank in Washington, D.C., but in fact, it's a very subversive organization. It was founded with monies from the Rubin Foundation, and Samuel Rubin was the owner of Fabergé Perfumes. Samuel Rubin was also a member of the Comintern. He was a Soviet agent, and he made his money by going to Spain during the Spanish Civil War and returning with a warehouse full of ambergris that is used to make fine perfumes. And he basically he confiscated it from the Spanish and brought it over here and then set up Fabergé Perfumes using the Fabergé name as a joke, because the Fabergé eggs and the Fabergé jewelry was famous during the Tsar's time, and they were, you know, Tsarist white Russians. So he stole their name and created this massive new industry with stolen property, and started the Rubin Foundation when he retired, and the Rubin Foundation founded the Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute for those who are listening. And these are both hardcore, and I would say, even though everybody says left-wing, I would say these are communist organizations. The KGB, which when the Russian embassy was on 16th Street, the IPS's offices are directly across the street, and KGB folks used to hang out over there.
Hey, let me quickly turn to another topic with you, Jim Simpson. This is another issue on which you have been very deeply engaged for a long time. And that is this immigration, challenge we're facing. We are watching, as we speak, migrants by the millions flooding Europe, bringing with them something that in the Sharia supremacist tradition is known as hijra, a kind of colonization. You've been warning about it happening on a smaller scale, but nonetheless in a very troubling way in this country. Talk a little bit, Jim, if you would, about this effort by the president to ensure that people who are coming in share our values.
Well, you know, it's critically important, and it's critically important for that reason, first of all, but for a lot of other reasons, because frankly, the people who come in through the refugee resettlement program, the people who come in through asylum, through the unaccompanied alien children program, they are here to live off us. They are not here to take on our views about the Constitution. They're not here to assimilate. They are here to acclimate and live a better life than they lived before. And in particular, the Islamists are here to attempt to erect a dual legal system called Sharia. And you see it everywhere. You see the Council on American-Islamic Relations trying to do this. You see this in courts everywhere, where they're pushing, demanding their own special right to decide their situation, their legal issues unilaterally. And that's insane. That's a prescription for chaos in this country. It undermines the rule of law, which is the foundation on which our nation has survived and prospered for the last 200 years.
Jim, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your insights on several of these really important topics. We look forward to continuing our visits with you in the near future.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.